Ave podcast listeners, a quick note before we get started on this week's podcast. Way back in 2018, around episode C, Rhiannon and I made a series of episodes looking at the fall of the Roman Republic, the death of Caesar, and ending with the reading of his will. For the next six episodes, we'll be looking at the Liberators' War of 43 BCE, which is essentially what happened next. So if you want some background, dig out those old podcast episodes. You won't miss anything if you don't, just think of it as a bit of recommended reading. On that note, here's today's episode. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CLXXXII. The Empty Throne. Caesar's death created a power vacuum in the Roman Empire. While Antony struggled against the Senate to make a deal and assert his dominance, Octavian's imminent arrival presented a challenge he couldn't anticipate. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
After the funeral of Caesar, there's a lot of uncertainty in Rome. Cleopatra leaves. She doesn't have her protector there anymore, so that makes sense. And then various factions take the opportunity to stir things up in Rome. And you get some quite unexpected events, not just the power players we've seen before, but some unknown people try and sort of crawl their way to power.
The first objective of the Senate, I suppose, is to stabilize Rome and maybe get back to something a bit beforehand, but they don't even get that opportunity really, do they?
Well, presumably they want to keep the crowd in check.
Yeah.
And they want to make sure that emotions aren't too high, which is quite difficult after a funeral like Caesar's. Yes, they don't get the chance. And one of the reasons is that we get this character who goes by various names, but by Appian he's called Amatius, comes out from nowhere and claims that he is the son of Gaius Marius's son. So the Marius, who was the uncle of Caesar by marriage, he says basically that he's his grandson. This so-called Marius, this Amatius, was an imposter, and he had been working in Rome before under this imposter name, and Caesar had exiled him. Of course, Caesar likes to work the connection with Marius, and he doesn't want a rival doing that and working up popularity.
Sure, sure. So we've got Caesar's word, I suppose, that this guy was an imposter.
Nobody else seems to give him any credentials of all of the sources on that period. And certainly he's not mentioned really very much until this opportunity arises for him to come back to Rome and to grasp the rising emotions that are left after Caesar's funeral.
Yeah, so he comes back and he's, I suppose, if he is Marius the younger, that he's got an established link as a result to Caesar and can say, you know, hey, I'm avenging the death of my beloved distant relative.
Yeah, well, he's not that distant, although it is by, you know, Caesar's aunt was married to Marius. So it's not a kin link.
Yes.
But yeah, he can try and take on the mantle of the so-called populist cause.
I mean, sorry, you say not a kin link, but in Roman terms, that's kin enough.
Yeah, it's not a blood relative, but yes, it had never stopped Caesar from making that connection.
Yeah.
And is probably the reason that he made so much of his Aunt Julia. So he can take on this role of avenging the man who'd actually got rid of him temporarily by saying, you know, being related to Caesar, I am deeply angered by his murder. So now I'm going to represent you, the people, and avenge Caesar.
So really see some of that anger. So what does he do? How does he agitate the crowd in Rome?
Well, Rome loves a monument, and he puts an altar on the site of Caesar's funeral pier. And it's a quote from Appian: he collected a band of reckless men and made himself a perpetual terror to the murderers. So in other words, he's obviously making speeches against Brutus and Cassius and threatening them.
But it also insinuates he's got an angry mob mentality kind of behind him.
Yeah, exactly, that they're going to go hunt down Brutus and Cassius. And in fact, he's quite successful in that because Brutus and Cassius then disappear from public life at Rome. And eventually they will leave Rome itself.
So Antony must be going, yeah, this is all great, but I suppose there comes a point where this might get a bit out of control.
Well, yes. I mean, Antony needs to be seen as the person who now has the balance of power in Rome. Mm. He can't really cede that to somebody else. And Antony seems at this point to be trying to play it so that he can represent the Senate and also represent Caesar. He looks like he's trying not to take sides. He's been prepared to dine with the assassins, but he's also someone who's been close to Caesar and is trying to get that faction on board.
Yeah.
It's not a very successful tactic because people seem to want divisiveness at this point. It's quite topical, really. And so Antony kind of has to get rid of him. So continuing from Appian, book 3, chapter 3, and here talking about Antony, Appian says, it was said that Amatius was only waiting an opportunity to entrap Brutus and Cassius. On this rumor, Antony, making capital out of the plot and using his consular authority, because remember he's consul for the year 44.
Make the most of it, dude.
Arrested Amatius and boldly put him to death without a trial, which is technically illegal, that you shouldn't do this to a Roman citizen.
But the consul can technically do it. Well, he did it, so.
Well, this is a time of extreme disruption where most of the rules of the Republic have been broken at one time or another anyway.
And in his defense, Appian did say boldly, so.
Yes, indeed. He gives him a traitor's end as well because his body is dragged around the city and thrown into the Tiber, according to Appian, in order to deter his followers. So this is the end you will meet if you do this kind of thing. So it's the worst kind of death and post-death that you can expect as a Roman.
Mm.
His followers are not happy, of course. They protest, there are riots, and Antony reacts to this by sending in troops. So this is using the army against Romans themselves.
So were the Senate okay with Antony throwing his weight around, his consular weight around to that extent?
They're kind of perpetually suspicious of Antony, and they're shocked because you should be shocked by troops being used in Rome. Remember, they're not meant to enter the city. Mm. Everything about this is extra constitutional, but we've seen a lot of that.
Yeah.
But they're also, they're content that Antony is really coming to the defense of the senatorial side because Amatius has been an opponent of Brutus and Cassius. So again, it looks like he's trying to keep to keep the senatorial side happy in this case.
Mm. But it's interesting that the pro-kill Antony argument back when they were taking out Caesar was that he might set himself up to be the next Caesar. And these kind of actions, this kind of reaction to a rival kind of shows that that might have been a valid worry.
Well, you could see it both ways. You could certainly see it that way, that he's the only one who is going to have power.
Mm.
You could also see it as him opposing somebody who's trying to take on the mantle of Caesar and
yes,
to avenge
yes.
him
mm.
And potentially rejecting monarchy. Around this time also, Antony abolishes the position of dictator. The dictatorship is gone, never to return. But of course, if you know what's coming ahead, then emperors are coming. They don't really need the position of dictator.
Yeah, they don't need it, yeah.
But that is a sign, you know, Caesar had made himself dictator forever. He had abused that republican position, which is meant to be temporary. So it's another sign that Antony is rejecting some of Caesar's more extreme moves. And it seems to me that at this point, he's desperately trying to keep the Senate happy, to keep things on an even keel, while at the same time, the Senate are probably quite right to be a little bit suspicious because he's not going to put up with any rivals.
Yeah, yeah. So how did the plebs react to this? So this is the second champion who has recently bit the dust.
Yeah, they're not happy. According to Appian in the next chapter, book 3, chapter 4, this tumult was quieted, but the extreme fondness of the plebeians for Antony was turned into extreme hatred. So Antony might have made the Senate a little bit happier, but he's lost the people at this point, at least.
Can't have it all. So who was Amatius?
I'm pronouncing it Amatius, but then okay. I've never actually heard anyone say it out loud.
Well,
so
there you go.
It's not the kind of thing that gets taught in universities, usually.
Well, I'm going to leave all of that in. So who was Amatius?
Well, there are various different versions of this. He's even got different names. According to Valerius Maximus, he was a former eye doctor. That's a bit random. Called Herophilus.
It's also very specific.
Well, yeah, but sort of, you know, not coming from a senatorial family or a political family, an eye doctor.
Mm.
With a Greek name, indeed, Herophilus. Livy says, and he specifies his class here, he was a low-born individual named Camartes. Again, a Greek name.
Mm.
Appian's the only one who calls him Amatius. So we got three different names from three different sources, which suggests that the ancients really didn't know from not that long afterwards, in the case of most of these sources.
But they were pretty sure about the imposter aspect of it.
Nobody seems to suggest that he really is a descendant of Marius. There's no evidence for that at all. And in times of disruption, it's not uncommon to have imposters coming along and claiming to be somebody with power, somebody with influence.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who's listened to Emperors of Rome will remember 100 years on from this, when Nero dies.
And there was about three of them.
Yeah. And again, that's the end of the Julio-Claudians, end of a dynasty. So that's the kind of time that these stories will start to ferment and people will arise from nowhere.
Mm.
In the case of Nero, claiming to be him, so not to have died, as it were.
So Antony now has a plebeian problem. Ooh, that's good alliteration. So what does he do to try and get them back on track a bit?
Well, he tries to get in on this idea of memorializing Caesar.
Mm.
So Caesar's veterans have already put up a column. Maybe Octavian, remember the great nephew and heir of Caesar, was in on this because he's now got money to throw around. The veterans had put up a column carved from a single block of marble, which is always very expensive, right? Not drums. Mm-hmm. You've got to find a huge piece of marble.
Yeah.
With an inscription to the father of the fatherland, Pater Patriae, which is a title the Senate had given to Caesar. It might have had a statue of Caesar on top of it. This is, a hugely noticeable monument to Caesar. And Antony tries to put up a competitor to that, a competing statue of Caesar at the other end of the forum. The one that Antony puts up is actually on the speaker's platform, which is a very prominent position.
Yeah.
So we've got this sort of competition for how much do I love Caesar going on. And this is Antony presumably trying to put right what he's done wrong in the eyes of Caesar's supporters by killing Amatius. I have to say that something we haven't commented on is that Octavian must have been quite happy that Amatius had been got rid of as well, because he's considering himself the true heir and he doesn't want anybody else coming in on that grief. All right, he's going to make maximum use of that grief, whether genuine or not, and see himself as the defender of Caesar's memory and the avenger of his death.
Mm.
And you imagine around this time, he's also looking very carefully at what Antony does. He doesn't want him treading on that too much either. Octavian's very young at this point. He's only 19.
Mm.
So in a way, we're working from what he does later. But he makes himself both of those things, the avenger and the commemorator and the bearer of the name and the only true Caesar.
Being the one who is named the heir, though, that really would count in his favor for that, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, as I say, I think that he would probably have been glad to see the demise of Amatius. And, of course, he hasn't had to do it. Antony's done the dirty work for him.
So Antony is consul still, but the clock is ticking, if I can use that tired old metaphor. So what does he use his position of power to do?
Well, he wants to make sure that he's got people in perhaps more permanent political positions. Most positions are only for a year, but a job like Pontifex Maximus, chief priest, is for life. Caesar had been chief priest, so that is now vacant. So he gives out jobs like that to Caesar's allies, his old friends, namely Lepidus, his now made Pontifex Maximus.
Yeah, all right. So that was a role, though, that was promised to Octavian in the will, wasn't it?
Yes. And technically, you can't really leave that job in a will, but Caesar's broken all the rules.
I was about to say, there's a lot of technicalities that Caesar hasn't let stop him.
Yeah. And in the aftermath of all of this, when you can just go ahead about 20 seconds if you don't want to know, but Octavian's going to win.
Mm.
When he wins, he doesn't kick Lepidus out of that position.
All right.
So he lets him stay there.
But that's his triumvirate buddy as well.
Yeah, although by that point, he's kind of got him under house arrest almost.
Yeah.
So he leaves him in that position. He can't really make much of it until he dies. Mm-hmm. So Octavian does become Pontifex Maximus. But by that point, he's called Augustus. And it's not until around 12 BCE.
It will come.
Antony also recalls Sextus Pompey, so the son of Pompey, who had been Caesar's civil war rival, and gives him various honours, like making him the head of the navy, commander of the sea. The Senate is very happy with this because Pompey had been on the senatorial side.
Yeah.
Remember? He kind of cements the relationship with Lepidus, the man he's made Pontifex Maximus, by engaging his daughter to Lepidus's son. And he starts spending Caesar's money.
The money that he was minding.
Yes. Octavian doesn't get all of it. So presumably part of that will be on donations to the people, or certainly keeping the people happy. And he manages to get a law through, because remember, as consul, he expects to be sent as a proconsul, a governor of a province the following year.
Mm.
And he gets a law passed. This has to go through the Senate, which will make him the proconsul of Cisalpine and Transalpine Gaul. So this had been Caesar's province in the 50s. He'd started in Cisalpine Gaul, which is northern Italy, and Transalpine Gaul, Provincia. Caesar's army has been sent east to Macedonia, but he has them recalled to go with him to Gaul.
Okay.
So he's going to take Caesar's troops. And that's important because they're loyal to Caesar. And presumably if the next guy can make the link with Caesar, which Antony has been a little bit rocky on, but clearly been trying to do, then they effectively get a lot of the power that Caesar had by having his troops on side. But also Gaul is a good position for him to be in because it's not too far away. So he might be, as he is quite soon, preparing for war in Parthia. And it's a 5-year period he asks for, which is not normal, but it's what Caesar was given to, that he will have a position not too far outside of Rome, outside of Italy, which is a powerful place to be, a wealthy place to be, but not too far from the center of power.
Yeah. If I was a Senate, I'd be a bit worried about all of those kind of chess moves that he's making.
Yeah. Pretty clever. And in some ways, surprising that he's not the eventual winner, because he's sort of doing all the right things here, I think. Now, at this point in Plutarch's life of Antony, he gives us an indication that despite all of this, Antony is not going to be the one who succeeds. He's not going to be victorious. And he does that in the time of honored Greco-Roman fashion of a dream, a kind of prophecy in a dream.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, as he lay asleep that night, Antony had a strange vision. He thought namely that his right hand was smitten by a thunderbolt. The right hand is the hand of power, you know, it's the one you hold your sword in, I guess. And the thunderbolt comes directly from Jupiter. So it represents the king of the gods and the god that you take the spoils to after a successful war. So all of that suggests that he's not going to be the ultimate victor.
Okay, okay.
Of course, Plutarch knew that.
Oh, yeah, Plutarch knows the ending. Yeah, yes. So that's Antony's power play and good use of your year as consul there, Antony. So how is the rest of the players in Rome reacting to this?
Well, Octavian had been away, but he came back in the April, so the month after.
He was sent away to essentially train up for the Parthian War by Caesar.
He'd been sent to Greece, to Epirus. When he comes back, he formally accepts his adoption. He begins calling himself Caesar, which is a powerful title to have.
It's interesting that throughout the rest of the texts at this point, he is just called Caesar. Because I was kind of there going, wait, Caesar's dead. Why are they bringing him? Oh, so yes.
I mean, a lot of textbooks will continue to call him Octavian and then Augustus. Because we have to make a distinction between Caesar. So it's easy to forget that he's calling himself Caesar now. But that is important. And of course, that makes the most direct link you can.
Yeah.
And it plays on that Roman naming practice that sons have exactly the same name as their father, or at least the firstborn son.
So he comes back, he takes on the name of Caesar, and I assume would see Antony as his direct rival at this point.
Well, it looks like it, because remember, he may have been involved in setting up the column to Caesar. And certainly we're told by Plutarch in the life of Antony that when Octavian tried to set up, and here I'll quote, a golden chair in honor of his father by adoption, according to a decree of the Senate, Antony threatened to hale him off to prison unless he stopped trying to win popular favor. So he's making this dedication of a very pricey object, which will, again, in the mind of the people, make that link very strongly. Which he could easily argue is just him honoring his father. But of course, it's a reminder to the people. And Antony knows that. And so he threatens him. So this is not a good beginning for what will eventually be a sort of alliance between the two of them. Antony sees him as a bit of an upstart and kind of underestimates him and just tries to put him down. So Octavian works his way into those who've got a say or any power at Rome. He begins to have dinners with people like Cicero, right? Cicero's been a bit on the outer, but he wins him back over. And certainly at this point in the mid and late 40s, Cicero is speaking in very complimentary terms about the young Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
In lots of his letters, he'll say, this is a brand new Caesar. We got a lot more hope here. You know, he's clearly not the man that Julius Caesar was.
Cicero would essentially see him as somebody that he could mold. So maybe he doesn't fulfill the ideals of the Roman Republic. But when the alternative is Antony, I kind of think Cicero would go with Octavian.
Yes. And remember also because he's just 19 years old and Cicero is now very much drawing towards the end of his life. He doesn't know it, but he's going to die the following year. And he is, what, 63 at this point?
Yeah.
So he would very much be able to see himself as in a mentor position, given that this man has now been left without a father.
Mm.
And he's only just a year or two after the point at which Romans considered that boys were even beginning adulthood. And remember, technically, he's not of age for any of the magistracies. That rule's going to go out the window very soon, and it's already being destroyed, really. But yeah, he would see himself as somebody who could advise and, you know, maybe mold, as you say, this young Octavian.
Cicero also takes a direct kind of stand against Antony, doesn't he? And uses his power and his rhetoric skills in the Senate.
Exactly. Well, Cicero has kind of absented himself from the Senate, okay, because of all of the disruption and the upheaval and all of this business going on with trying to defend Caesar and being against the assassins, who Cicero, he wasn't part of it, but he kind of sympathizes with them. Antony comes out and criticizes Cicero for not being in the Senate, which Cicero reacts to very sharply.
So he comes back.
Absolutely. He comes back and we've got a record of 14 speeches against Antony. That's all they do. They're called the Philippics. They're not called that because of anything to do with Antony's name, but because Cicero quite self-consciously models himself upon the Greek orator Demosthenes, who spoke out against Philip II of Macedon, Alexander the Great's father, who had, amongst other things, taken over Athens.
So Cicero sees himself as carrying on that tradition.
Exactly. And of course, Philip II was a king.
Yep.
Athens was a democracy until Philip invaded.
Mm.
So he's trying to make that parallel. We were a republic until people like Caesar and Antony started trying to absorb power. So he speaks about Antony basically as a bit of a louche, as somebody who's drunken, somebody who spends too much money, who's cowardly, who's lazy. He really trolls him in this way.
For 14 speeches.
For 14 speeches. It's a bit more than Twitter. and very effective. Of course, Cicero is the foremost orator of his time, so he can really do it. He can go to town on Antony, and he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
He will pay dearly for this.
I was about to say, yeah, okay. Maybe he shouldn't have done the 14th speech. Maybe past the 10th was pushing it a bit. That's what Cicero's up to and what Octavian's doing. So how about the two assassins, Brutus and Cassius?
Yeah, look, Antony can't win here. He's kind of got too many people resenting him because Octavian isn't too happy with him for not pursuing Brutus and Cassius, but Brutus and Cassius themselves are not happy with the provinces they've been given. They look at Antony and say he's got this plum province of Gaul. They've got Crete and Cyrene in North Africa.
I quite like Crete.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Cyrene wasn't a bad place to be, but they're not powerful places. They're not places from which you can launch a war.
Yeah.
All right? They're not places that are going to have a lot of troops. Not recently conquered, quite peaceful.
So they've pretty much been sent to be out of the way.
Yeah, exactly.
And they don't like that.
Yeah. Antony says, well, too bad. And if you don't like it, you can just go elsewhere.
Which they did.
Yes, he says it in a slightly more threatening way than that. And so they go east to raise their own troops. And this is the precursor to civil war against them.
Mm. So that's in the east. And meanwhile, in the west?
Sextus Pompey is causing trouble.
Again.
So, yes, he's gone off to Spain. So we've got problems at two ends of the Mediterranean here, and he starts stirring up a revolt over in the west. Meanwhile, Antony can't even get into his province because Decimus Brutus has kind of stuck himself in Cisalpine Gaul, and he refuses to give up the province to Antony.
That was the third, essentially the fifth beetle of the assassination, if I can term Decimus like that.
Yes, he had been heavily, you know, really important in the assassination.
Or for the Australian audience, the fifth wiggle.
Okay. I think the wiggles are worldwide now.
Okay, the fifth wiggle. Guys, there was a fifth wiggle.
Yeah, so I don't know. If I were Anthony at this point, I'd want to go home.
So Anthony...
but he doesn't.
So Anthony essentially has all these people who aren't necessarily working with each other, but they are all working against him in their own way.
They're very definitely not working with each other. Brutus and Cassius and Octavian are polar opposites.
Yeah, but you've got Cicero working with Octavian now and them becoming quite close. You got Sextus Pompey, who, you know, you might be able to talk to on a good day, but they are all uniformly going, we need to take Antony out.
Yeah, they all seem to be working against him either through propaganda or even, I guess you could say in Decimus's case, force, because he is just refusing to go and he's got an army there. Antony really needs to get to his province.
So his consular year comes to an end, 44 BC. Goes over to the next calendar, new consul will be coming on board. What does Antony do?
He has to be in a magisterial position. All right, this is what we saw with Caesar and the last civil war. If he wasn't in a magisterial position, then he's vulnerable. So Antony needs to be in his province at the beginning of the next year. So he takes his army north to confront Decimus. And while he does that, Octavian brings 3,000 troops to Rome, some of them Antony's former troops, and he makes his alliance with Cicero even closer.
So it's pretty clear at this point, with this many competing interests and this many men raising troops at the head of armies, that it's heading towards a second civil war now.
It looks like it. We actually are going to get some moves before we're going to get another civil war and then what looks like an alliance and then another civil war. So it's not just one civil war coming.
Sure.
In a way, it's a succession. And all of this, of course, has come as a result of Caesar being murdered. You could make the argument that if Caesar had continued to act as dictator, he could have maintained peace in Rome. Obviously, it was a peace that a lot of Roman elites would not put up with, and not just elites in some cases. But Caesar himself, according to Suetonius, had predicted, is more important for Rome than for myself that I should survive. Should anything happen to me, Rome will enjoy no peace.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.